Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Zero to Exit. This is Ankur and Nilima, your hosts. In today's show, we have Upa Campbell, the Chief Strategy and Marketing Officer at Accurix, an early-stage cloud security startup. Upa is a serial exiter. The last four startups that she was involved in have all had successful exits. Three companies ended up getting acquired for hundreds of millions of dollars, and one ended up going public and is now a multi-billion dollar enterprise. Although she has played multiple roles in the tech industry, she's a marketing extraordinaire. She knows how to build a marketing machine that can help startups and big companies get to critical market traction. If you're an entrepreneur who knows how to build or sell tech products but don't know how to get your potential buyers to pay attention, you don't want to miss this episode. Hi, Upa. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ankur and Nilima. I'm glad to be here.
You had an interesting upbringing. Growing up, you moved around multiple countries. I believe you were in Kuwait during the Gulf War. Tell us a little bit about your childhood and how it helped shape your worldview and career.
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually was born in India, but I moved to Kuwait at a very early age. So I spent a lot of my childhood there. We happened to be on vacation. We left a couple of days before the Gulf War, and we were in the U.S., then the war happened. And so we were stranded in the U.S. for about 3 months to see if the war would end, but it didn't. And so then we ended up actually moving to India to spend about a year and a half there, which is a big culture shock for me, specifically because I didn't really speak the state or Hindi, the national language. And so I had to learn a lot from scratch. And then ultimately we returned to Kuwait for a few more years. And then I moved to Canada for college. And then I ultimately moved to the U.S. So it's been a lot of ping-ponging around the world, but it really has helped me become who I am today. It was very uncomfortable moving. You know, I've been at 8 different schools over 12 years, and it was a lot to take on as a child. But today I really kind of cherish that experience, and I think it's made me not fear making all the changes and jumps that I have in my career. As my background, I've been an engineer, then I went into product management, and then I went to marketing. It's always been a little bit scary, but I think I've embraced change effectively.
That's fascinating. As someone who also moved around quite a bit growing up, although in not as many cool places as you have, the one thing that I learned is that change is always hard, but once you embrace it, it's always for the better. One of the things that I learned about you is that you're an early bird. You have produced some of your best marketing work at 2, 3, 4 a.m., a lot of successful people have this early morning routines. As someone who is not an early bird, I'm always curious about how people do this. First of all, like, is this something you still do? Were you always an early bird, or is this a habit you formed over time?
Absolutely. For better or worse, that is still my routine today. It's not something that I ever planned, but effectively, it just started with, I think, my master's. So I was doing my master's full-time while I was also working full-time. And so I'd work during the day, and then I'd come home, and then I'd be really tired. So I learned that it was faster for me to fall asleep and then like wake up in the morning and study before work again. And so that's where I picked up this habit. Then came the kids, and then I was up at 3 a.m. anyway. And so, you know, it's just become a part of my lifestyle at this point.
Interesting. Outside of the fact that there are no distractions in the morning, is there anything else that stood out for you about the early morning routine?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's the quietest hour of my day. There are no emails, no Slack messages, and no kids running around. And also, I'm just highly alert and a lot more productive. So something that might take me 3 hours at night will easily take me an hour and a half in the morning. And so I'd just rather be more efficient.
So Upa, when you follow this, do you sleep like fairly early and the kids kind of follow that routine? How does that work out?
Yeah, definitely. By the time I'm putting the kids to bed, I'm never sure if they're putting me to bed or if I'm putting them to bed. So it just kind of works out that we all go to bed early. Then that's what allows me to wake up.
And do you know what you're going to be doing first thing in the morning when you wake up? Do you plan that time?
It's actually pretty well planned. So I like go to bed with a game plan. By the time it's like 9, 10 o'clock, I'm just like not effective. So the only thing I'm capable of doing at that hour is making a to-do list. And so I kind of have a game plan. When I wake up, these are the things I need to get done. And so that's kind of just how I operate.
Pretty cool. And you've worked for multiple startups. In early stage startups, company culture really, really nurtures a lot of things. What's your general take on the culture?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's actually an area that I feel very passionately about. You know, at the end of the day, a company is nothing but really the people that make it. And so making sure that you create a culture, whether it's a startup or a large company, and even maintain it during the kind of the pandemic that we're in is really, really critical to me. And so for me, it's really, at the end of the day, culture is about respecting your people and supporting them in whatever way you can. So it's not, you know, there was a day and age where it was about the fancy food and all the amenities of a fancy campus, but here we are all at home. And so at the end of the day, the most we can do is be supportive of our employees. That could be giving them the flex time to deal with kids as they need to. That could be just saying, hey, randomly, team, we're going to give everybody the next Friday and Monday off just because, you know, it's mental health day for the team. Or I really appreciate some companies just a week ago had given their employees the day off to go and vote, or it was like a no meeting day. So even these things are just kind of supporting the movement. There have been blackouts on social media. I think these are the things that add up at the end of the day and build culture. It's not really physically what you give them anymore. And so I think really focusing and honing in on what your employees care about is really like important, especially now.
What you just talked about seems obvious and common sense, to me at least, and every company should do it. Why do you think most startups still don't get this right?
I think there's definitely a lot of high pressure, high stakes kind of situation here. I feel like a lot of companies don't plan very well. And so, you know, lack of planning leads to work bleeding into people's personal lives. To me, like the moment I start asking my employees to do something on the weekends is when I realize that I'm not planning things correctly. And yes, ad hoc surprises happen, but at the end of the day, like when this becomes a recurring issue that you're pushing people to work through the weekends, every weekend, back to back to back, that's a sign of a problem that people have to take a step back and just say, what are we doing wrong? Could we be more effective, more efficient some other way?
So sounds like you are a planner, just like me, Upa.
Definitely.
Yeah, so I have the same point of view. Like what you can plan, you should. Yes, there's definitely things you can't plan, but it should not become a recurring theme. A related question on this one. You've also changed from an engineering to product management and marketing. Each of these roles also come with many cultures, right? How was that experience? Because you're working with very different type of players. They have very different expectations. Was that hard?
That's a really good point. Yeah. Someone told me that you have to understand before you are going to be understood. And so I think it's actually by Covey in the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. For me, like you said, they're all different personas. And so obviously understanding them and understanding what matters to them and how they work was important for me to then be able to, you know, get work done. And so that, you're absolutely right. It was definitely a learning experience.
So you've had 4 consecutive exits. SonicWall bought by Dell, Zscaler went IPO, Polera got acquired by Oracle, and then RedLock was acquired by Palo Alto Networks, I think 2 years back. Picking the right company, and especially very early stage startups, is very, very hard. How did you manage to do that once? Not twice, but 4 times.
Yeah, well, while I'd love to say that I have the foresight to pick successful companies, I don't really think there's a formula for it. There's always, it's more of an art than a science at the end of the day. So the engineer in me looks for companies that have technologies that are solving critical problems in the market. But equally important to me is really the team. In fact, that is my number one criteria when I'm looking at a new startup. Do they have a tech vision beyond what is being built today? Do they have the ability to execute? Because some people may have a perfect vision, but then they're unable to execute. Do they have empathy for their customers and their buyers? Do they understand them? Do they try to understand them? Or are they really focused on just building a product? And then most importantly is cultural alignment. There is just something to be said about chemistry that you can't make up, either there or not. And so at the end of the day, when I picked these companies, I was really just focused on looking at the teams and gauging whether it was the right team for me and whether, you know, I would have fun.
Interview process is a lot like speed dating. People present the best version of themselves in a short amount of time. How do you ensure that the founders and the interviewers are actually doing what they say they do?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I like to actually ask the same question to a lot of my interviewers because I want to see if I get different answers. And generally I ask them like, what is the, you know, like what's the strategy? And if I get different answers on strategy, I'm always suspicious because that means that they're not on the same page. And so sometimes, you know, it's, you can kind of work through it and ultimately get everybody to align. But if they're so far off, that's always a red flag to me.
So what you're saying, Upa, is you are choosing the company as much as the company is choosing you.
Absolutely,
do you also do reverse interviewing?
I certainly ask my fair share of questions during an interview. I'm not shy about it because at the end of the day, it's a big commitment to get into any company and especially a startup. It's a lot of risk. And so just making sure that you ask the right questions, the technical questions, but also the right soft questions. What's your working style? Like people hesitate to ask that because people don't want to know. Some people don't want to admit like, oh, I don't work on weekends. And I'm pretty upfront. I don't work on weekends, right? It's not entirely true, but you know, obviously when there's a launch, I will. But I want to align on these things upfront because if there's a mismatch in expectations from the beginning, it'll never work.
That's fascinating to hear. Typically, people would look at more quantitative indicators like revenue growth, NRR, DAO, MAU, but sounds like you focus more on the qualitative aspects. I also think that you're giving yourself much less credit for finding the right startups to work for. You know, is there anything else that stood out for you about Zscaler, Polera, Redlock, outside of the culture and the tech vision?
It's market timing, too. I would say so. I'm looking to see. It could be an amazing product, but if I feel like the market isn't there yet, that's what usually spooks me. I do tend to do a quick check with friends in the space, practitioners specifically, saying, hey, if this was a product, would you buy it? Right? If you had an idea that solved this problem, would you buy it? And so that usually helps me vet out whether the timing is right.
Still staying with that question, Upa. So on the culture thing, how do you judge culture in 5 interviews, right? Typically, it's such a soft thing, as you said, but it's very intangible as well. And answers can be made up. I've heard from several people that they actually sometimes work together to kind of figure out if the mindsets merge. Any insights on that? Because as you said, culture is so important.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of the time I actually start with the CEO. I kind of want to see how their overall approach is to the interview, right? Are they on time? Are they tardy? Are they gracious during the interview? It's just little soft skills. And when I ask them difficult questions, do they get defensive? So there's a lot of things. If I push on them during an interview, how do they react? And so it's just gauging those soft things that I kind of know that does this person have some humility or are they really arrogant? So I can gain some of these things by just kind of pressing different buttons during an interview.
Switching gears for a bit, you know, marketing has 2 big functions. One is creating compelling content, and the other is to get people to pay attention to the content, which we often refer to as demand gen. I want to first focus on content, be it website, pitch deck, data sheets, and others. What's your perspective on creating world-class content?
Yeah, so I would say that this is probably an area that was never a strength. Coming from an engineering background, I really geek out about the product. And so it's something that I've had to really learn over the years. There's a book by a friend, Ken Rutsky. It's called Launching to Leading, How B2B Marketers Lead, Create Flash Mobs, Marshall Parades, and Ignite Movements. It's really fascinating. It really helped me understand how to do messaging and positioning. It's focused actually on messaging for cybersecurity companies. And so it talks about Palo Alto Networks and the whole story of the next gen firewall, talks about FireEye. And so really gave me a perspective on how to actually create a messaging that stands out in the market. And so I would say using some sort of framework is really important. It sounds elementary, but in Ken's book, he talks about the hero's journey, and it basically has the story split into 4 parts. The first part is what is the situation in the market? So, you know, what's changing? And then the second part of the story is about why the current products aren't meeting the needs anymore. And then the third part of the story is what the reimagined solution needs to look like. And then the fourth part of the story is if you were to have this product, what your transformed future state looks like. And I find that a very helpful framework. I'm constantly using that as I build messaging.
Great insights. Thanks for sharing them. You've been doing launches for a while now. Do you recall any big failures, like a product launch that just didn't land? And if so, what did you learn from it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the area that I underestimated by a long shot in marketing was SEO. I just didn't understand the complexity of that field. I made the mistake of building a website that was not optimized for SEO, that had a lot of technical issues, that got dinged for SEO. I didn't really understand how to prioritize keywords. Obviously, everybody wants to rank for like the most popular words like cloud security, but it's really hard to immediately show up on page one when everybody else is buying for it. So understanding that there's a long tail of keywords to go after as well, you know, was something I didn't understand. Building the domain authority of your website, because it's a brand new website and Google doesn't know who you are yet. And all those things are just the little things I didn't know a lot about. And so, you know, my lesson learned there was to ultimately at my next startup, make sure I hire a really strong SEO agency to help me get off the ground and be the subject matter expert in that space, because Google changes the algorithm all the time and there's no way for me to keep up with it. And so that's a lesson I learned the hard way, but you know, I'm definitely better for it today.
Upa, you talked about SEO. How should early stage startups think about demand gen? Marketing budgets are limited and going to conferences like Dreamforce, RSA can pretty much exhaust all of the marketing budget.
So given, you know, COVID, it's really changed the game for marketers in a big way. All the big conferences that we used to all rely on are gone, or at least they're virtual now, and it's a completely different experience virtual.
And are available for free, aren't they, or they're not?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. So there are some companies that are hosting conferences for free, which I very much admire. But then there are other companies that are charging a lot for conferences, even for the virtual format. And so you've got a little bit of everything. I'd say as an early stage startup, it really, like, I would really focus on the digital marketing piece because that has the most reach. And so really making sure that, again, you know your message, and then you scale that message, build lots of content so that you can get to a lot more people faster online than trying to access people at shows, which can be very expensive. So having crisp content will allow you to get to people, and then going to the channels where you think your buyers hang out is really important so that you can make sure you promote the content there. But the one thing I will say is that before you dive into a demand, building your demand gen strategy, I would say that make sure you have the instrumentation in place and the telemetry to be able to measure what's working and what's not. So I'm really big on analytics. And the first thing I do when I, you know, go to a startup is I build my MarTech stack effectively. So I have a way to do marketing automation. I have obviously my Google Analytics turned on. I've got my SEO tools turned on. In fact, the most important tool to me is the attribution tool. So some sort of attribution tool such as Visible is really important, because at the end of the day, that will tell you what are the touches in the buyer's journey that ultimately led to the sale. And even though you only have a handful of customers initially, that data is invaluable. So really focusing on building the tech stack to get that analytics from day one is really key.
Got it. If you had $100, how would you allocate it between SEO, social media, conferences, channel marketing, analyst relationship, and other means to promote the product?
Yeah, I've actually never split my budget that way. I would say that I would almost do 50-50. The big thing that I always focus on is brand, actually. So I spent a lot of money on building the brand, and you know, I spent a lot of money on PR. A lot of people are very, they're not on board about spending money on press, but really it is a good way to get a microphone to your message and get it out there, provided that you have the right stories to tell. And so I spend a ton of money on PR. I'd say the rest of it is probably spent on demand. But then again, you have to weigh very expensive demand tactics versus cheaper digital tactics, possibly.
Got it. And any insights into whether money spent on AR, analyst relationship, is it worth it? What's been your experience with AR?
Yeah, it's a long tail game. So I would say that it is an investment that you make, but it's not something you might see a return on right away. But if it's one of those things, if you keep at it with the right set of analysts, I think it really has returns. And so at Zscaler, we were the leader in the Magic Quadrant, I think, for five years in a row while we were there. And that kind of made us in a big way there. And so if there is an existing market Magic Quadrant, definitely make sure you're in front of it. But if there isn't one for your space, I would still say build those relationships with the analysts, because you know they get a lot of inquiries from your buyers, and it's really important. If there isn't a Magic Quadrant, that they're at least talking to those buyers about you.
Makes sense. How about social media marketing? Is it more of a consumer thing, or is it pretty relevant nowadays in B2B and SaaS and security context as well?
Yeah, it depends on the business. So if you get into fields, where you're engaging with developers in the community, I think there's actually a lot of use for those tools, specifically Twitter. Some of these communities are very, very active on Twitter. And so I would say that depending on the context, I would pick the social channels appropriately. So if, again, you are, developer focused, you want to be on Reddit and obviously not promoting your products, but definitely talking about those relevant topics to your buyers. You want to be on posting things to Hacker News and Quora and stuff like that. So there's different channels depending on kind of your target market. And so these are all effectively now considered social media.
Super. A follow-up question on that one. You said obviously not promoting the products on Reddit. So maybe it's obvious to you, but for our listeners, it may not be. Any insights there?
Yeah, so a lot of these sites actually don't allow you to promote products on their sites. But if you, let's say you're a company that has an open source product, that's okay. It's okay to talk about it, saying, hey, we have a new version of this open source product. You can do that. Or, hey, we have this great white paper on how to, the top 10, how-tos or for DevOps or DevSecOps. And so those kind of educational content is okay, but you're not allowed to promote your products. And so you have to be very careful.
And how important is the role of an evangelist in this sort of new world order, open source marketing, if you will? Is this starting to gain a lot of traction, or are we still in the early days?
Yeah, so I think that's actually much more important. What you're touching on is this notion of go-to-market strategy. And there's been a democratization of IT. And so there's been this huge movement of open source, and developers are very bullish about open source. And so as we move towards that, I think we go from being sales-driven sales go-to-market strategies to more product-driven. And so really engaging with the community, it's a lot more bottoms-up today than it has ever been. And so, making sure you engage with the community with open source products or products that are you can do free trials on online without ever having to talk to sales is really important. And so I think we are seeing a movement, especially with, as more people move to the cloud.
So with the digital marketing piece, the bottoms up usage, do you foresee enterprise B2B sales process change dramatically in the next 2 to 3 years?
I absolutely do. Yeah, very much so. I think now more than ever, we have to have a way of allowing users to try things online before they ever speak to a salesperson. And so really building your products that cater to that, making sure you have a sales motion that caters to that, because if there are people that are buying your products online, then your deals are going to be smaller, in which case you have to have a way to, you have to have a low-cost way to be able to go to market. And so you're not hiring large enterprise sales teams necessarily. I'm not saying that that's not required. There'll still be very large organizations that have, that are very complex that you will need your enterprise sellers for, but you probably may want to invest in a high velocity, smaller deal model as well.
What aspects of product marketing that most people don't understand?
Yeah, a lot of people think product marketing is about product launches, but really to me, it's about driving revenue all the way through the funnel. With that, a lot of people try and hire product marketers that are very technical, which is great, great attribute to have. But really, I'm always looking for somebody who understands demand gen. And so being able to partner for the product marketer to partner with my demand leader and, generate that top of the funnel leads is really important, because the product marketer is the person with the domain knowledge. And so they can help create the right content to create top of the funnel leads. And then they can work with the sales team to create those tools needed to drive those leads through the funnel and ultimately close business. And so I'm looking for product marketers that are revenue centric and really focused on, and when I measure their success, I measure their success on whether we hit the revenue number.
But how have you seen the marketing role change in last 4 to 5 years through your journey? Previously, marketers, as you said, were also working with sales. There is the demand gen, there is the product marketing function. And as the products are getting more technical, marketing is also working very closely with product management. Has it gone all the way down to working with engineering for certain things? Has it changed in the last couple of years?
Yeah, so I feel like marketing, at least in our space, is getting more and more technical. And so I think, Ankur, you asked a question about evangelists. I think they're super critical. So there was a time when I used to hire a lot of content marketers, and you know, there's still a lot of value for that. But I'm finding that I'm hiring a lot of evangelists because I need people who understand the technical side of it, are able to engage top with the community at the top of the funnel. And I need them to be able to also present well. And so the skills I really look for today is technical, being able to present, and also strong writers. It's kind of a hard combination to get, but I'm leaning towards more of that kind of persona for my top of the funnel versus your traditional content marketer.
I guess evangelists in B2B are more like the influencers in B2C. We just got to get them to show up more on TikTok.
Absolutely.
Last question before we go into our rapid fire. Although there's been a huge wave across the tech industry to hire women and diverse candidates, reality is that we just don't have enough women representation in the industry. What advice would you give to aspiring women in tech to have a successful career like you have?
So first and foremost, I'd have to say that the only reason I've been able to really focus on my career because of my husband. He's been behind me every step of the way, giving me the support, the space that I needed to be able to really focus on work. And he's actually been the one who's always pushed me to the next challenge. And it's always been scary, but he's always been right there to help me out when things got rough. And I, you know, there are a ton of men out there that I see today helping their wives or their girlfriends or partners basically get to that next level of career. So really hats off to the men out there that are doing that. But as far as advice to women, my advice would be to really focus on being business minded. It's something that I shied away from for many years myself, where I really focused on my siloed function, whether it was product or marketing. But the more and more I got closer to the business, like getting closer to your buyers, understanding what they want, understanding the competitive landscape, really thinking about how to price things and how to make money, especially when you're an enterprise-focused business, is really important. And so first, instead of getting into the nitty-gritty of things, which is what I have a tendency to do, it's really like think big picture and think about how to build a company, because that will really go a long way in helping you establish a leadership position amongst your team.
And how about managing work-life balance? You have two little ones and you managed to have a successful career. And kind of the drop-off of women in workforce post-COVID has been astounding. And I assume that's because kids and, you know, other duties at home. What advice do you have for women who are as competent and ambitious as you are, but are unable to have a successful career due to the work-life balance aspects?
Thanks, Ankur. I appreciate that. I would say that it is something that I struggle with all the time. I'm always trying to find that work-life balance. I think that really taking a step back sometimes and looking at like how to optimize is really important. So if you're seeing that you're spending too much time doing something, step back and think about how you could do it differently is important. But also, I would say that for me, there was a period in my life where I felt like I had lost that work-life balance. And just taking a step back and saying, hey, I am not spending enough time with my family. This is not the right job for me. I need to make a change is really huge. Recognizing that is really important versus letting it get away from you, because that can happen very easily. And so whenever I found that happening, I've made some drastic changes. Either I've had to change my role or change the company. And that real self-realization needs to really be there. But and also don't, I would say to women, don't hesitate to go and talk to your manager about it. See how you can change things up and make things more sane for yourself. It is always possible. If they're willing to work with you, great. If they're not willing to work with you, then you're going to have to make some tough decisions for yourself, but it always works out for the best.
That's great. This brings us to the final segment of the show, the rapid fire round. We'll ask you some easy yes or no questions on a variety of topics. So we'll get started with our first one. Who do you admire the most in marketing?
It's René Bonvenu. He has taught me so much in the time that I work for him that I really admire the way he works and has so much passion for the marketing trade, I guess.
Yeah, René was the CMO at Palo Alto Networks, and I believe he is now in EIR at Battery Ventures, an advisor in a bunch of companies. Next question, your favorite book or blog or podcast?
NPR.
Awesome. You have two little girls. When they grow up a bit, what advice would you give them about leading a fulfilling professional and personal life?
It's the age-old figure out how to get work-life balance, because that's the only way to be happy.
All right. This is a good one. If you were the president of the U.S. or the Madam Vice President, what's the first thing you'd do to make the country less divided?
Put some more women in Congress.
Good answer. And the last question, where can people learn more about your most recent work?
You can certainly follow my current company, AccurIGS.com. We've got a LinkedIn channel as well as a Twitter feed. We're just getting started, so I'd love to obviously hear feedback from the listeners there.
Well, that concludes another episode of Zero to Exit. Upa, thank you so much for being here and taking the time. Maybe we can have you in a couple of years when AccurIGS has a successful exit and you'll be doing the unthinkable, have five consecutive exits. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, fingers crossed, but thank you for having me. You guys have been very kind and generous with your time. I look forward to being here next time.